JFF Jeffersonville.
From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the Reporters Roundtable. Our local journalists are back to discuss issues affecting our listening area with WJFF's Patricio Rubio. It's election season. Election Day is just 10 days away. Are you ready to vote? Today, we'll meet a Wayne County couple who is. They have voted in 50 consecutive November elections and stayed married throughout all the political ups and downs. And Silver Lake House. It was a Pennsylvania boarding house that gave families happiness and an escape from the city. Now a new book recounts that way of life. We'll speak to author Julia Sweet about her memories of Silver Lake House. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. Food and Drug Administration officials say the benefits of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine outweigh the risks for young children. NPR's Jen Newman reports on the FDA review that's been released ahead of a meeting of outside experts next week.
Federal scientists say kid-sized doses of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine provide robust immune system response against all variants, including Delta. An FDA review found the two-dose shot, given 3 weeks apart, is nearly 91% effective in preventing symptomatic infection in young children. The analysis of Pfizer's data comes before a public meeting next week, where a panel of independent advisors will debate whether the shot should be given to children ages 5 through 11. According to CDC data, 1.8 million children in that age group have been infected with the coronavirus. Two full doses of the Pfizer vaccine are already recommended for anyone 12 or older. Jen Newman, NPR News.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says a deal on President Biden's domestic priorities is very possible. Talks continuing this weekend as Democrats are reported to be closing in on a deal on their social and climate change agenda. Less than 2 weeks remain before Election Day in Virginia when voters will select a new governor. And NPR's Amy Held reports that Democrats have new reasons to worry as early voting gets underway.
New polling shows Republican Glenn Youngkin has closed a lead to run neck and neck with his Democratic opponent. Former Governor Terry McAuliffe wants to win his old job back, and former President Barack Obama is hoping to give him a leg up at a Richmond campaign event today. Virginia has leaned blue in recent years. Democrats flipped the legislature in 2019. Then former President Donald Trump lost the state by 10 percentage points. But President Biden's approval ratings have slipped in Virginia and nationally. Still, he's set to campaign for McAuliffe, an old friend, next week. Youngkin, who doesn't want to alienate suburban swing voters, has not invited Trump to campaign with him. Amy Held, NPR News.
Saudi Arabia announced plans to reach net zero carbon emissions by 2060, joining more than 100 countries in a global effort to try to curb man-made climate change. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, heard here through a BBC interpreter, said more than $180 billion would be invested to help the kingdom reach its goals.
I announced today Saudi Arabia's target to reach net zero emissions by 2060 through its circular carbon economy approach, while enabling its economic diversification. We will preserve and reinforce the kingdom's leading role in the security and stability of global energy markets.
The announcement came a little more than a week before the start of the global climate conference being held in Glasgow, Scotland. This is NPR News. Court records show actor Alec Baldwin did not know that the weapon he fired on a movie set in Arizona contained a live round. A search warrant filed in Santa Fe says Baldwin was told the prop gun was safe to use before the fatal shooting of a cinematographer and the wounding of the film's director. After a 19-month delay because of the pandemic, Broadway's longest-running show, The Phantom of the Opera, resumed performances last night. Jeff London reports on the celebration.
The party started before the 13,370th performance of The Phantom of the Opera. Composer Andrew Lloyd Webber, producer Cameron McIntosh, and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer gave curtain speeches, while the audience of over 1,600 people donned white phantom masks over their face masks to pose for a picture taken from the stage. After an extended standing ovation at the show's conclusion, the audience, which included Lin-Manuel Miranda and some of the Real Housewives, exited onto 44th Street, where Webber himself DJed a dance party. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
The rain that fell in Northern California this week came as a welcome relief amid a historic drought. It also helped contain wildfires. But now National Weather Service forecasters say a big storm this weekend could lead to flash flooding in areas that have been burned. And they're warning of road closures due to heavy snow in parts of the Sierra Nevada mountains. I'm Jael Snyder. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include EBSCO, offering Excel 5 for continuous learning and growth through professional development, helping employees develop soft skills in 5-minute increments. More at ACCEL5.com.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's our monthly Reporters Roundtable, where we check in with local journalists about the stories and the issues they're covering. WJFF's Patricio Rubio is the host, and he sat down virtually with Liam Mayo of the River Reporter and Chris Rowley of the Shawango Journal to take a look at cannabis again, and also the look at local elections coming up. Chris Rowley from the Shawangunk Journal starts off the roundtable with an update on the new cannabis facility that will be opening up in Ulster County near Ellenville.
Yeah, we've had a couple of meetings, one on Zoom and one in person. Sabrina Noah of Cresco Labs has shown up and given a very smooth presentation of what they plan to do, what's in train for that. And it is all kind of amazing. You know, I mean, it's 380,000 square foot facility, but most of that will be full of plants, not people. And lots of jobs, good money, 55,000 is being quoted with benefits. I think this may draw a lot of people out of, restaurant work, I can see some ripple effects coming from this thing, because they want 300 to 400 people. I mean, this will be a challenge for everybody else who employs people around here. Anyway, she gave a very, very smooth presentation. Town board and what they actually did was they had a they called their own planning board meeting, which they paid for. That's not cheap. And they gave a presentation, and basically it turned into a kind of meet and greet between Cresco Labs and the town of Worcester Planning Board. And that was a very smart thing to do. Tonight is the next planning board meeting. I think they will be there, Cresco, but I don't know if there's anything new for them to say. And at this point, it's that planning thing of like, establishing a lead agency, preparing for seeker, beginning the discussion that takes you up to a public hearing. So that was the big story there. The other side of it, of course, is, as you noted, that the Office of Cannabis Management, New York State's official body, has just been constituted. They had their first meeting, I think, about 10 days ago. And they are beginning to regularize the rules and everything for dispensaries and all the rest of it. But meanwhile, all these companies are in a race to get into production. So you have this sense that the plane is taxiing down the runway while people are attaching the wings. So anyway, we'll have to see.
Yeah, it seems like everyone's sort of playing catch up. I think maybe because of the delay from the last administration, but everything is sort of now ramping up now. And recently in Narsburg, there was a cannabis workshop held at the Narsburg Union. I know that it was well attended, and it held information about agriculture and the economic benefits that cannabis can have in an area. I know, like I said, it was well attended. Liam, in your reporting, have you seen sort of a shift in opinions because of this meeting? Has it had any effect? Because there still seems to be a negative vibe towards cannabis, for lack of a better word, a negative vibe towards cannabis. And I guess, you know, having this consortium, having this workshop, got the information out there. Like, again, Liam, do you think opinions have changed because of it?
I don't know that people's opinions have changed so much as become a little better informed. Sort of two of the major things that were talked about at that consortium were the business potential of the cannabis industry in terms of just billions and billions of dollars that could be brought into the state of New York for this industry, and how local towns, if they end up signing on, get a 3% share of the tax revenue for the businesses, I believe, that are just within their town. But that's not, that's a fairly significant chunk of change. So there's the business side of it. And then there's also, like you said, the cultural aspect of it, where marijuana is seen very differently from just going to the store and picking up a bottle of wine. And at the consortium, a lot of what was talked about was just how a lot of that negative perception of marijuana comes from a sustained propaganda campaign against it, sort of dating back to the 1930s. So it's not any more harmful than going to the store and picking up a bottle of wine. And potentially there are major health benefits from doing that. But people's perceptions against it have been sort of tainted by illegalization and this smear campaign against it. And both of those points made it into town board discussions around the region about cannabis. There were a lot of people from Tustin who attended both the Cannabis Consortium and the town board meeting a few days later, where they were voting on the cannabis issue. And the same thing sort of happened over in Keshecton, a neighboring town. But it was a lot of people, I think, who went to the Catskills Cannabis Consortium already favorable towards marijuana, and who left being still favorable to marijuana, but just a little better informed, and trying to take that to town board meetings and to referendums and sort of share those views. I don't know that it necessarily changed anyone's mind. And that's sort of, I think, apparent at the town board's meetings as well. When Tustin voted on their town board hearing on it, two of the members of the town board voted to allow dispensaries. Two members who had sort of previously expressed that they were for that, so it wasn't a change from the Cannabis Consortium. Two others voted that they wanted to ban it, and the Tustin Town Supervisor, Ben Johnson, abstained from the vote because there was a potential conflict of interest with him owning or being in partnership with Bar Veloce, a liquor establishment. He's since confirmed with his legal counsel that there wasn't any conflict of interest, but that there was some administrative thing they messed up in having the vote the way they did. So they're going to need to re-put it to a vote at the next couple board meetings. But in that time, a lot of the people who attended the Cannabis Consortium are putting together a referendum so that the town can vote on the issue. And it's sort of a similar thing happening over in Keshecton, where a lot of the town board is considering it, but they're mostly so far have been voting against it. And there's talk of a referendum that's going to be put together so that the town can end up voting on it. So there's still a lot of back and forth opinions. And I think a lot of people who are afraid of marijuana a little bit. At the Tustin Town Board meeting, there were a few people who showed up and were very against it, and people who said that they worried about it being a gateway drug, and people who worried about opioids in connection with it. And while I think the research is trending towards viewing marijuana not as a gateway drug, that it is, that it doesn't lead you to do harder and harder drugs, there's still that fear there that I don't know has been addressed or can necessarily be addressed at this time. So I think opinions are as they have been in the county, but there's more and more information coming in, which should, in theory, help everyone make a better decision.
Since the December 31st deadline is looming, do these referendum votes have to happen soon, Liam?
Well, yes and no. the town board would need to make a decision by December 31st if they're going to opt out. But the way they do that is by passing a local law. And local laws themselves are subject to permissive referendum, where within a certain amount of time after the law is passed, you can try and gather signatures. And if you gather enough signatures within that time, you will hold a referendum within the town about whether or not that law should stand. So I think in theory, say a town board passes that law late in December, you would still have that 30-day or however long a period it is, period, to gather the signatures you need for your referendum. And you could hold that, I guess, early next year or so. So whatever the case it is, it'll happen soon. But I don't think it's quite as restrictive as the deadline for town boards.
Right, right. Like I said, it's going to be interesting when people have that chance to vote on something and to see really the opinion of the community. Also here on Radio Castle, we've been following the elections, the local elections, and we've been having regular interviews on the local edition with candidates who are running. Last year, there was a big election year with the president and a lot of state senators changing. And for this election year, a lot of the elections are hyper-local, town supervisors, town councilmen. And even though it's not a big election year, those elections, those hyper-local elections really are important to how your town is run. They have effect on your taxes. They have an effect like what we just talked about, cannabis dispensaries in your town. Chris, what are some of the key races that you're following in your area?
In the town of Wolsing, we have a race for supervisor. The current supervisor, Terry Houck, has the Republican line, the conservative line, and he's got the third line, I can't remember. And he's racing against Eric Alexandriantz, who is on the planning board, is a former IT person for the town, and has a background in computer science and music. Actually, he's a highly regarded flutist. He's also originally from Russia and won awards in the Soviet Union for the flute. Houck has made an absolute mission to not raise taxes. I mean, I think that's his strongest suit. Wolsing has had very low tax increases, if any at all, actually. There have been zero tax increases. So he's standing strong on that. So that's the supervisor. Elsewhere, the big one is for the 14th county legislative district with a 10-year veteran in that situation, which is Craig Lopez. And he has the Republican line, conservative line. And against him is Kelly Palinkas Greer, who is a well-known Democrat from, I do believe she lives in Walker Valley. And so this, in a way, will pit the Wolsing Democrats against the town of Shongum Republicans. The district is the only one in Ulster that goes across the ridge. So it has a foot on either side of the Shongum Ridge. Lopez has done well. He's with that district. But of course, right now he's in the minority, Ulster County, having swung Democratic. So that one. Then on the getting hyper local, we have a couple of slots now open on the Village of Ellenville Board of Trustees. There is a campaign there. TJ Briggs, a well-known personality in the village, who was a former mayor of the village and a long-term county legislator, is running for that one of those seats. Other people are engaged too. There's Susan Nyby is running. She's the Republican. You know, these are all fairly well-known people. And will be interesting to see, you know, what kind of response we get. How many people will come out without any presidents or even, you know, state senators on the ballot, you know. And sometimes this is a little depressing to the press because, as you noted, these are the very important elections. You know, this is where your tax dollars are going to be, you know, sorted out. And people just look the other way. And, you know, if they can't get excited about, I don't know, whatever's going on the border in Texas, they don't get excited about their own taxes. It's kind of crazy. But here we go. But we look forward to it. I've talked to a lot of people this week who have been who are involved, and we'll be talking to some more. So, we'll see. I can't, you know, call the races for anybody in particular, you know, but we will see if we get a shake-up at the county legislative level or at the town of Old Boston level. Usually I find incumbents win, but there's always, you know, there's always the other option, you know, so we'll see.
It'll be interesting to see the numbers after the election day to see how many people actually turned out to vote and to see if, you know, compared to last year when it was a big presidential election happening. Liam, what are some of the key races that you're following in your reporting?
One of the bigger races we're focusing on, still hyper-local, is the Town of Highland Town Supervisor race. And that has John Pizzolatto on the Democratic and line and a Lifting Neighbors Party line, which I believe he is starting together with several town council candidates against the incumbent supervisor, Jeffrey Haas. Haas has been in the position since 2015, I believe. And both in that race and in a couple of other races across the county, Ambry Cruz running for town council in Coshecton, a couple of candidates running for town council in Tustin, the emphasis has sort of been on getting people involved in local politics and getting people interested in local politics and getting sort of more people invested. There's been a sense across a couple of those campaigns that a lot of town politics is controlled by the incumbents and that it gets to be more a little bit of a closed system. And a lot of the people trying to go up against those incumbents are saying, hey, let's get more transparency in here. Let's get more people to the town board meetings. Let's find out more of what's happening. And that, interestingly enough, kind of ties into the cannabis issue where a lot of people, both in Tustin and Coshecton, and I think a little bit in other towns as well, haven't known that the town board is talking about cannabis until very recently. So the boards have been meeting and talking about it, discussing it for months and months and months at this point. But it's only been recently that people have been turning up to the meetings. And a lot of times they'll turn up to the meetings and say, hey, what is this cannabis issue? What are we talking about here? So it's, I think candidates who are trying to capitalize on that or just noticing that and trying to say, hey, let's get more people to these town board meetings. Let's get a little more transparency in the decision-making process and let's get a little bit of change in here. And I'm not going to try and call any of the races either. This is my first time covering local town board races, but it does seem that the incumbents have a pretty strong position. But again, you never know. It'll be definitely interesting to watch.
One thing you mentioned is party names. And I'm noticing maybe in my reporting in the past, maybe I have not paid attention to it or not noticed it, but I'm noticing a lot of the candidates have party names, new party names that they formed their own parties or got together with people and formed parties. Like in Fallsburg, Kathy Rappaport is running under the Preserve Sullivan line. And in Bethel, Ralph Liff is running under the Ralph Liff line. So I'm wondering if that a sign of people wanting to get involved more into politics and sort of not fitting into the normal Democrat and Republican lines that they want to sort of want to break away from that. What do you guys think? Chris?
Well, we've seen small parties, you know, have come up. Some have established themselves, you know, Working Families, you know, didn't used to exist. Now it does. You know, sometimes a party does stabilize. You know, these things come and go and the Republicans and the Democrats remain. You know, it's hard to see anything really serious happening on their level, but, you know, there can always be change. And here's one thing I would throw in here is that the growth of access to the internet and the growth of the internet and its various memes, you know, in social just discussions, right, family discussions, whatever, right, is possibly leading to more fragmentation, to more ideas about, you know, hyper-local parties, a party built around a certain, you know, single issue that's of major concern to, you know, Southwest Ulster County. Well, we could have one. But, you know, again, the Republicans and the Democrats will always be there. That's my feeling, you know, and, you know, Now, we should just make the point in Wawarsing, the incumbent has only served a single term as supervisor, but he has been on the town board since 2004. And in that period, he served as the liaison on the board to almost every bit and parcel department in the whole administration. So he kind of knows where all the where everything's hidden. So, you know, that's one of the things that incumbents get is the experience, the knowing where everything is. And I think that helps them. And people coming in who aren't, that's a problem. They have to climb that hill, you know, but we'll see. I do think we may be on the cusp of an era where we'll get a lot of little parties. A lot of little parties will spring up. And how many survive? Well, time will tell.
Right. And how about you, Liam? How do you feel about that?
I'd add to Chris's point a little bit about incumbents knowing where everything is and kind of having the advantage of experience, because that's something I've seen in a couple of races so far. The incumbents or the sort of legacy people in these roles sort of tout their experience or it's a certain way of getting things done where they'll know the highway supervisor. They'll know like the people who you need to call when you have an emergency. They'll know how like all of the infrastructure in the town works and how it's all put together. And that's one of the strengths they bring to their role. And a lot of the challenger candidates don't have that experience. Many of them, this is a first time or a very early time running for public office at all. And a lot of them are small business owners. So they bring a very different type of experience. They bring, and they're saying, hey, let's bring some change in. Let's bring more of a business sense to it and bring a bit of revitalization. But at the same time, they're lacking that kind of nuts and bolts experience with the infrastructure of the town, with just sort of keeping the machinery of day-to-day life running. So it'll be interesting to track from both sides, if these incumbent candidates can sort of learn from the revitalization that small business owners and that kind of mindset can provide. And if any of these challenger candidates get elected, if they can sort of grow into and adapt into taking on all of the responsibilities involved in the day-to-day management of a small town.
And I'm noticing maybe it's just an effect from Trump that a lot of people who have been in politics before, like business owners or people like from the community who have not been in politics before, going into politics and getting involved. And I don't know if this is because of that, because of Trump's success getting to the White House with no political experience. It'll be interesting to see, you know, future races going forward. Will this trend continue? And obviously, you know, when you go into political office, at one point, you don't have any political experience. But it seems in a local level, a lot of people start off like joining the some committees or getting involved with the planning board, a town board, and sort of working their way up. Because like going from a planning board, being an alternate, going to the main planning board, and maybe moving up to going for election for a town council, then, you know, having experience there and eventually have a run for town supervisor. So I'm wondering if this trend is going to change that people have no political experience and goes just straight to like town supervisor role. Liam, what do you think?
I think I may have overstated a little bit the lack of political experience of some of the new candidates. Candidates like John Pizzolatto has run the Upper Delaware Scenic Byway for a very long time. And other candidates have like experience working with the legislature to write pieces of legislation. But like you said, they don't have that experience of coming from the planning board up onto town council and from then into the supervisor position. So it's just seeing whether that kind of experience is transferable, whether the experience of working with the small business or with legislatures sort of from the outside or from another perspective can translate directly into being at the center of a town's infrastructure.
Right. And Chris, you mentioned something previously about information overload. And it seems like since, you know, now with the elections now, everything is sort of decided on social media with, you know, meme postings, and people are taking that as fact instead of going to a reliable news source like the River Reporter or the Shawanagog Journal or the Sullivan County Democrat for getting their correct election news. are you having a hard time combating that, the information overload out there on the internet, and sort of your message gets drowned out by that?
From my POV, I really don't ignore it, what I see on Facebook or social media, but I tend to trust essentially what I see at town board meetings and in discussion with town board members and that kind of thing. And so give it sort of straight from the angle that I'm reporting, rather than to sort of bring in very much about that's on social media. And of course, the thing that is, rumors and conspiracy theories and all that kind of stuff, right? They feed on basic on ignorance. If somebody has very little foundation in local history, understanding the local politics, understanding the place they live, then it's easy to tell them, well, you know, almost anything, right? And they'll believe it. I mean, or part of them will believe it. They won't believe it entirely, but they'll be susceptible to more of it, you know? And so that is one of the issues. So all we can do, you know, who write for what we might call legitimate press, right, or the radio, is try to increase the amount of real information out there. Because here's the thing: if it's real information, then it does pan out. You know, I mean, if it's a real thing, then it does stand. Whereas if it's not, if it's nonsense, then, you know, it will blow away. So you just have to leave it there and then let a few more months go by, and then someone will go, oh yeah, there really is this, you know, oh, okay. And then it will be accepted. But that's what we're dealing with, you know, and of course, you know, it's a busy world where everyone's got their family, everything else under the sun going on. How do they keep up with it all? You know, especially second home people. I mean, are you trying to keep up with the politics in Brooklyn and in Fallsburg? You know, I mean, how much time do you have for all that? You know, I mean, are you also reading New York Times or Wall Street Journal or following national politics? I mean, it could be a full-time job, couldn't it?
Right. Oh, definitely. And how about you, Liam?
Yeah. Dealing with sort of, or the place of a paper in this sort of mass of information is something we've been talking about here at the River Reporter, and something our publisher Laurie Stewart likes to say is we're about connecting the dots. Let's say all of these little bits of information everywhere are like little stars in the night sky. This one isn't something Laurie says, this is something I'm saying, but a newspaper won't necessarily take all of those stars and just put them on one of these things, one of like the printed papers, but it might draw the connections between them so that someone who only has like 10 minutes in their day to read an article rather than 2 hours to try and sift through all the bits of information can look up at the sky and see a constellation that makes sense and not just a bunch of little individual pieces of information. And that's something I'm trying to do in reporting as well, where it's like, I read a lot of information from Facebook and I try to get a lot of those little like nuggets of information, but then the reporting afterwards comes from taking all of those and saying, okay, how does this bit connect to this bit? How does one Facebook post made by the candidate in a Tustin race connect to this thing that happened on the town board over in Highland like 2 months earlier? It's sort of a breadth of knowledge, and it's seeing things through a very different lens where, yes, it's helpful to have all this information, and it's amazingly helpful to have all this information. And if you're a citizen who is incredibly interested in politics and has the time to go out and just analyze all this information for yourself, all the more kudos to you. But as a newspaper, we can, and as a radio publication, we can sort of sift through that a little bit and highlight the connections between various issues and sort of draw out the broader themes to talk about and to let people know about.
I think that's a great way to put it, and a really clear picture that sort of sums it up. Again, you're joining us for the Reporters Roundtable. Thank you again to Liam Mayo, the River Reporter, and Chris Raleigh from the Shawangunk Journal and News Atomic. And you will be listening to Radio Catskills Reporters Roundtable, October 2021 edition. Thank you again. I'm Patricio Rubio for Radio Catskill.
short break, and when we come back, we'll talk to a couple who have the secret to a successful marriage: voting. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Our annual Thanksgiving show, Turkey Confidential, is right around the corner. And this year, we're doing things a little different again to keep everyone safe and healthy at home. So we're asking for your questions in advance. Send them to us by recording a voice memo on your phone and email them to us at contact@splendidtable.org. Or go old school. Leave us a voicemail. 1-800-537-5252. We can't wait to hear from you.
This music can reach further than we've ever imagined, into worlds that have so little to do with our culture, the culture of Ashkenazi Jews. The music transcends. It takes hold. Someone hears it, falls in love with it. That's why I'm so happy to share this with you. I'm Aaron Bendich, and I play a selection of Jewish recordings on Borscht Beat on Radio Catskill.
Sunday afternoon at 1.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The election is coming up soon, so two dates to circle for Pennsylvania voters. October 26 is the last day to apply for an absentee ballot. And if you're voting in person, you can head to the polls from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. on November 2nd. In New York, all poll sites on November 2nd are open from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. Just a few weeks ago, Wayne County inducted 40 new voters into the Pennsylvania Voter Hall of Fame. The Voter Hall of Fame honors Wayne County voters who have voted in 50 consecutive November elections. They were honored for their dedication and patriotism, and this week we had the honor of talking with a few of those new members of the Voter Hall of Fame. Reporter Meg Duff spoke with Bob and Peggy Simons, retired teachers who live in Damascus Township, who have been voting together and married to each other for the past 52 years.
Peggy and Bob, you were both just honored in the Pennsylvania Voter Hall of Fame. How was the ceremony?
The ceremony was very inspirational. It seemed like democracy at work because the commissioners, the three commissioners in Wayne County, were so pleased that the ceremony existed, so to speak. It made one of the more pleasant duties of their job to have people wanting to vote and help with government.
As teachers, both of you, how do you prepare young people to vote? Or how did you?
Well, when I had GED classes, I would go to the courthouse and get a sample ballot to bring to class to show what was on the ballot. And one time the GED students went to the courthouse and registered. At the courthouse, because we could just walk over. We were in town, in Homestead at the time. I can tell you I got some independent registrations. I guess they weren't sure they wanted to be either Republican or Democrat.
Like in a high school class, you might discuss issues and try to show how those issues are, you know, expressed in the campaigns of the candidates. I used to teach a poem called The Death of the Hired Man by Robert Frost. And one of the ways of penetrating the poem was to show how similar the two characters, main characters, the husband and wife, is a kind of dialogue, how similar the husband's point of view was to a typical Republican position, at least at that time, and how similar the wife's point of view was to a typical Democratic position on an issue, and show how Frost at least did a good job of representing both points of view, you know, that they each had good points. So if that helped anybody understand the poem, then my job, and I did my job.
And what was the takeaway there for students?
Well, the takeaway was that you have to apply all of your sensibilities to decision-making. If you're too much reason and logic, then you can come away as only partly human, now too harsh. And if you trust only emotion and pity, then you're going to most likely be taken advantage of.
I love that idea of bringing your whole self and all of your different kinds of decision making with you on election day.
That's right. It's reason and emotion both.
So back when suffragettes were fighting for the right to vote for women, some people said, maybe it doesn't matter because wives will just all vote exactly like their husbands. And obviously we know that that's not true, but it made me curious if you could tell us about a time when you disagreed politically and how you talked about it.
Well, I grew up with a parent, one Democrat and one Republican, so I always had different opinions at my parents' house. So controversy is normal. But
we discuss who we're going to vote for. I don't know. I think lately we've been in agreement. We'd have to go back, I think, quite a few years to come up with any differences. Peggy was a registered Republican when we moved here. She changed parties just because she felt the party, well, you can speak for yourself, Peggy, but I think she felt the party kind of moved away from traditional Republican values. So I think we're in agreement, and we do talk it over, who we're going to vote for most of the time.
I grew up with a father who would say his mother would roll over in her grave if he knew he voted for a person that she wouldn't approve of. Voting has always been serious in my life.
Peggy's from Tennessee, and the South was solidly Democratic back then, back in the 60s, and her mother was a Republican at a time when they didn't even have a Republican primary. So her mother made her an independent voter. You know, if you had a mother who was going to vote Republican and be a Republican Party chairwoman in her, what was it, the county, Peggy, or the, whatever, the municipality, then you learned to express your view independently of others.
I'm wondering if you have any stories about going to the polls.
Going to the polls has changed. It used to be a real community event, especially in Wayne County when the elections were, say, in a Grange Hall, and there was a dinner or a luncheon, chicken and biscuit. It was not only were you voting, but you were sitting down to eat, and people from out of the township would come and eat, or candidates would come from the courthouse. It was a very social time, and I miss that because recently we haven't even showed up at the polls. We voted by mail, so I miss that community aspect of how voting has been in the past.
Yep, that's the one disadvantage. We love the mail-in voting, but that is the disadvantage of it, that you aren't there with at least part of the rest of the community.
That sounds like such a different way to do it and so lovely. How long have you been voting? And if I can ask, how long have you been married?
Both are over 50 years. Married, 52.
So although I wasn't aware of the fact that it had been a completely unbroken chain of 50 November elections, that was a little bit of a surprise. But it wasn't too surprising because I do try to vote. And Peggy as well. In fact, if I were a little lax and thinking, oh, maybe not this one, I'm sure she would have gotten me to the polls.
I'm wondering if there's anything you would want to say, you know, after having made it out for 50 years in a row, about why voting is so important.
Well, it's your voice. It might seem like it's a very small voice, just a single vote. But when you realize that that's exactly what everybody else has, too, and that your vote weighs as heavily as anybody else. At least, now I say this with a little bit of a caution because there are folks out there who are trying to manipulate elections, I'm afraid, and maybe reduce the equality of a vote, you know, in the form of gerrymandering or restrictions on voting. That's why I think the voting rights bill that is before Congress now is the most important piece of legislation, more than infrastructure or anything else, because it's what guarantees that the government remains of the people and that everybody's say in that government is an equal say. So that's what drives me.
And I'm glad that there are opposing views and more than one political party, because I would not like to live in a government with one choice.
Right.
I live in a democracy, and I'm glad that we have choices.
Right.
Hear, hear. Do you have any advice for young voters or for young newlyweds?
Oh, man.
Well, for younger couples, there are lots of issues that affect having children. And we grew up when 18-year-olds, 18, 19, 20-year-olds could not vote. And that was during the Vietnam War. And that change was made so that people who were conscripted to go into the military were allowed to vote. So there are often issues that affect all ages, and but might affect young people especially.
Yeah, I don't know. It'd just be kind of the blatant advice to vote. That's all. Just do it. It's your right. And a lot of sacrifices have been made for you to have that right.
Trying to figure out who to vote for, that can be hard. When you're new to an area, everybody is unknown. There's a lot of local people you never heard of. And so you have to kind of read up or talk to people. So now you have to go online to research who you might want to vote for. When I go to vote, I always look at the sample ballot outside the building. So I made sure I covered everything that I need to cover or study at the last minute. If there's a question I maybe didn't read up on.
Yeah, right. If there's a ballot question, those are the hard ones. They would catch me by surprise lots of times.
The thing that helps me the most know how to vote is some kind of magazine or newspaper that you get that has the same question for every candidate.
I frankly trusted most of the time the recommendations of PSEA, the teachers' union, especially on non-local offices, the state offices.
Married 52 years, voting for longer, it does sound a little bit like the couple that votes together stays together. Is that your secret, or is there something else?
Oh, my goodness. I'm not going to give that much credit to the voting. I don't know. What about you, Peggy?
No, you could still vote.
It's like,
not it, together and manage to stay married.
Well, good.
Yeah.
I think that's encouragement that, you know, many of us will need.
Well, it's a source of togetherness. The fact that we have political discussions, Peggy and I, and discuss, you know, where our vote is going to go, and some of the issues. I mean, she'll point out things to me that I didn't think about in an upcoming election. And that not only is good for our citizenship, it's good for the marriage, too.
Hmm. Meg recorded this conversation with Bob and Peggy on Wednesday morning. Thursday afternoon, that voting rights legislation that Bob mentioned, the Freedom to Vote Act, was blocked by Republicans in the Senate for the third time this year. For now, it's back to the drawing board. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Silver Lake House was a boarding house in Tyler Hill, Pennsylvania, that opened in 1951 and closed in 1975. In between those years, it left its mark on the lives of the people who visited and worked there, including Julia Sweet. She was both first a guest and then an employee. She writes about her experiences in her book, Memories of Silver Lake House.
Well, the experience that I had at Silver Lake House was truly very profound for me. I guess the most profound years were actually the years that I worked there, But I became very attached to it starting from the age of 2 in 1958 when my parents first began to vacation there. And so I collected all these memories over the years, and I found I was really straddling the, you know, city person's experience and the country person's experience, and there was a story to tell. So that prompted the book. I had thought about it for many, many decades, but didn't have the sort of leisure to write it. Once I retired, I began writing and spent 4 years on it, and I was very happy that it took 4 years because over those years, more and more people and stories emerged. So that that helped bring the story to life.
The house first opened in 1951 and closed in 1975. And as you say, it took a little while for you to put the memories together. It's sort of a tribute to an era that's long gone, right?
I would say so, yes. Although some people claim it's coming back, but I'm not so sure.
Well, you have a lot of memories that you're sharing in your book, and I just wanted to ask you about a few of them. I guess maybe when you first started coming there, what was it like for you to come from a relatively urban city background to this country home?
Well, I certainly can't remember, you know, the first first beginnings of all of that because I was too young, but I know that it evolved into just, I loved being away from the denseness and the concrete. I loved being, you know, in a more natural environment. I was not alone in loving the air in Wayne County. I mean, that's one of the big draws, actually, for a lot of people to these boarding houses. So I guess the first thing is I just looked forward to, you know, getting into this environment. And it's, the other part is that the way Edith Dennis ran Silver Lake House, she made it very, very warm and welcoming, which is why people returned year after year. So you, even though you didn't own the, you know, the place yourself, you kind of felt like you were coming home every summer when you arrived. And that's kind of what remains with me. And then over the years, you know, I built up different memories and associations from being there in the country. One small one, for example, is there was a Mrs. Abraham in Tyler Hill, and she had a little antique store in the back of her house. And, you know, I kind of enjoyed going there. It was, you know, a different setting, different experience for me. So these little adventures, if you will, added to, you know, what I associated with it.
And you were a guest there until you were 15, and then you went to work at the house. And how did that change your perception of things?
Well, it changed it greatly. First of all, I became much more aware of what it meant to, you know, deal with the guests. Overall, they were not very demanding. But as I share in the story, you know, every once in a while you'd get some people who left you with memories perhaps you'd rather not have. But so, you know, learning to deal with the public in that sense was very significant. One short story is not mine, but one former employee remembers that, this is in the 50s, a guest complained that her morning egg was not sufficiently cooked, but she was complaining on behalf of her dog. So that was part of
her dog?
You know, shift. Her dog didn't get a properly cooked egg. So, you know, every once in a while you get these kind of things that happen with, you know, with the public. Then maybe the biggest shift for me was that my day became all about work. You know, as a guest, my day was, you know, kind of about hanging around and so on. But once I started working there, it was all work. And because I didn't have a car and I really didn't have any, like, big outside attachments, I just worked 7 days a week. I could have had a day off, but I wouldn't even have known what to do with it. One morning I asked for a morning off because I wanted to go take a rowboat out on the Silver Lake in the morning fog. So I did that for 10 minutes, and then I said, okay, I'm done, came back to the kitchen and said, I'm here. And then the whole rhythm of the work day, so it began very early. Edith was always up at 6 rolling out pie crusts in the kitchen, or the pantry, I should say. I had to sweep the front porches and then go in and set up, you know, the breakfast tables and shortly after, you know, I was joined by whoever else was working, but they weren't staying over. We would serve breakfast, which was the only meal where people could order food. And then, it, you know, once breakfast was cleaned up, both for the guests and for the men who came up from the Dennis's dairy farm, the morning chores were launched, meaning, you know, cleaning the rooms and the cabins and doing the laundry, you know, which we did like every day because we changed towels and things like that. And then it all got hung out on the line. It, also during that time, there was preparation for dinner, which was the like noontime meal. And a lot of salad was made. So we, all those things happened before dinner, and then dinner was served. That's the biggest meal of the day. And once again, when that was cleaned up from the guests and from the men, we had a little time off, a couple of hours, before we started the whole process over for supper.
When you maybe were done with work, you might go to the lake to swim, but there were some things in that lake. Can you tell folks what were
in that? Sure. Well, I'll start with the more pleasant things that were in the lake. So there were a lot of small fish in the lake, and some of the guests would request a fishing license so they could just enjoy doing that. And Edith would, you know, go to town and get them the licenses, but the children didn't need any. And I don't think anybody really brought up anything of note, really, from the lakes, but there was one story where a young boy was very attached to nature, and he asked Edith if she would cook anything he brought up, and she ended up cooking him his frog's legs. But I know what you're alluding to. There were leeches in the water, and the Dennis's always put lime into the water to, you know, kind of dispel them, but every once in a while, you know, it wasn't often, but once in a while, somebody would come up from the lake and you'd see, oh, they had a leech on them. And I mean, I'm reasonably tolerant of a lot of animals, but that is just one animal that's repulsive to me. So I was always looking very, very carefully when I went in the water. But, you know, they tended to be in shallow water, like, you know, near the shore. So if you went out and swam in the lake, you were unlikely to encounter a leech.
You write the work was endless, it was hard, but that it taught you something, especially being a guest and then being a worker at Silver Lake House. What did that teach you?
Well, the first thing really was about a work ethic and how it was openly expressed that hard work was very, very valued. And that's not the kind of language that I would hear at home in the city, you know, not from my family and not from my, you know, cohort. But it was very openly expressed. People who are hard workers were told that they were, and, you know, everybody talked always about how hard a worker Edith Dennis was. And that sort of, you know, set the tone. So that was the, I guess, one big element right there. And then getting to know people, you know, from the country, just as the country people felt like the city people were a different breed, I saw how, you know, the country people sort of regarded life differently, and that was eye-opening for me.
Do you consider yourself a city person or a country person now?
I don't really consider myself a city person. I haven't affixed an identity in particular. I actually kind of felt personally that I had sort of three worlds that I lived inside at different times. So, you know, one of them was being a good student at a demanding high school in New York. And then another one was, of course, coming out to the country and spending my time, you know, like lifting heavy trays of dishes and all of those associated tasks. The third one, which I'm not going to get into, but it was that at home in Brooklyn, I didn't have close friends from school. It was a school that people came to from all five boroughs. So in the neighborhood, there was a group that sort of assembled, and I got to be friendly with these people who were not school-oriented at all, but they weren't country people, so I sort of moved among these three worlds. I feel good when I'm up in the country, but I can't really claim to be, you know, a country person. On the other hand, the area has changed so much since those days that I don't even know how many people, like in Honesdale or even around there, could claim to be country people. It's a certain mindset.
Yep, you're right. Well, we've been talking to Julia Sweet about her book, Memories of Silver Lake House. You can reach Julia via email. The address is sweet.julia25@gmail.com.
The Western Sullivan Public Library is sponsoring a presentation on Zoom on December 7th at 7 p.m., and more information will be forthcoming from the library itself.
Then we can give that out once it is on the community calendar. Julia, thank you for sharing your memories.
Well, you're very, very welcome. I'm happy to do it.
That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. Farm and Country is next.
WJFF, Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio.